This is Media Sales Mastery, the podcast for media sales professionals. In each episode, we bring you information, insights, and ideas from some of the industry's top thought leaders. Connect with us to help pick the topic and guide the show.
This is Media Sales Mastery, the podcast for media sales professionals. I am your host, Jamie Wood, and our topic today is unearthing killer insights. Now, there's a saying I use a lot, probably a little too much: data tells, but insight sells. And it pretty much sums up how I feel around the vital role of insights within the media sales transaction. So much of crafting a great campaign is about connecting an audience with an advertiser's brand in a way that makes perfect sense. Insights are kind of like the glue that does this for you. And so much of media sales is about the transfer of belief, right? The transfer of belief in that the campaign that you've designed is going to connect with and influence an audience to take action on that message. Let's also not forget probably the most important part of this. We operate in a highly competitive industry. And if your competitor is really good at insights, if your competitor nails an insight on a brief response, it's highly likely that they're going to differentiate the offering and they're going to be in a very, very strong position to secure that revenue. I have lost many a brief and a lot of revenue in my time from having competitors who are really, really good at insights. Okay, these things work. They drive commerce, they drive revenue, they drive great campaigns and great results. Our returning guest is Janelle Shinnes. Janelle's the head of client engagement at VML Y&R. This is actually a follow-up to one of the first ever podcasts we did on Media Sales Mastery, which was titled Data Tells, Insight Sells. I love talking to Janelle. Super excited to get into this one. So let's do it now.
The first five.
Janelle, welcome back.
Thanks, Jamie.
Good to have you back. You were actually, I think, like the third, maybe like the third or fourth episode we ever recorded. And here we are 4 years later.
Wow, who'd have thought? It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
So you've changed jobs since we last spoke, I think. Tell us a bit about your role at VML. What do you do there?
Yeah, so my role at VML is fairly broad reaching, but I think at the end of the day, you know, we're all about helping our clients solve some of their biggest challenges through the power of creativity. I think I'm really lucky to get to work with a very talented group of people who really thrive on understanding what's going on in the market and what challenges clients are facing, but also coming up with those ideas to help overcome those challenges. So I kind of think of my role, I'm a bit like a coach. I've got to have, you know, the right people for the right challenge on the field at the right time. So it's very different to last time we chatted, that's for sure.
Today's all about how to unearth killer insights. And I guess to frame the episode, maybe we need to put some definition around insights. In the world of kind of like media strategy, how do you kind of define the crucial difference between, say, like data, observations, and insights? Can you give us a bit of an example?
Yeah, absolutely. So data is usually, it's the statistic. And I think of data that's, it's the fuel that helps grease the insights engine, if you like. And then an observation, which usually comes from observing a data point, it's a statement of fact. So, for example, 95% of our people in our survey said they like the sound of purring cats. And then an insight is understanding, well, why is that? Why do 95% of people say that they like the sound of purring cats? And it's when you go deeper that you find the insight that, you know, it's because it's very therapeutic and it's very calming type of sound. So I think if you break it down, they're interrelated and one helps you get to the other.
Okay, that's a really great example. I'm sensing that you have a cat at home and that the cat was purring when you prepared this.
Well, maybe it was the opposite this morning. I wish she was purring. Perhaps she was annoying me with another sound that cats make. But anyway.
Well, great setup for the main topic.
Media Sales Mastery.
Because the podcast is really hyper-focused on the domain of media sales. And as someone who's worked across multiple roles, but I guess particularly someone who's been responsible for briefing and buying media in the past, why are insights so crucial to a brief response or to a solution? Like, how do they kind of feed into the value proposition that you as a buyer, you know, use to evaluate that campaign?
They are actually the fuel for good storytelling, and people remember stories and people understand stories. So any good pitch or any good sales proposal, how you use that that data or that observation to unearth an insight that helps you create a story around your media channel and why it's distinctive or why it's different or why it's better. They're the things that people remember. I mean, human beings, we're wired. We're wired to remember a good story rather than a bunch of insights or a bunch of, you know, statements of fact, if you like. And it's the story that stitches all of that together. And I think they're really critical to your sales kit, because if you don't use the data that you might have to turn that into a powerful insight which helps you wrap a story around your media channel, you're potentially missing some really great opportunities, because people do, you know, we're emotional creatures, and stories help us unearth that emotion and help us sell what's really special about our media channels.
That's interesting, the whole idea of storytelling. You know, I remember hearing something about like the legal profession and, you know, trying a case, and they said that one of the most critical parts of being successful in a trial is, you know, being able to assemble the facts of the case in a way that they can move through the jury's brain. So the most compelling data point, the most compelling case, unless you can actually put that into a framework that is, I guess, like a narrative framework or a story framework, it might not necessarily influence the jury, which I thought was kind of an interesting intersection, you know, between that and this topic.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because if you think about the legal profession, you know, lawyers do need to use those data points and use the facts, if you like, and have that into a coherent framework or story so that they can plead their case. Whereas, you know, if you just think about just arguing fact after fact after fact, or, you know, hitting home with data point after data point, how are the jury actually meant to sift through that and understand it? And I think the same applies when, you know, you are working in media sales and you need your end client to remember what's special about you and remember why you should be on a media plan and remember where and when and how, you know, how you're utilized. So I think storytelling is a way to really unlock that, because people remember stories. It's embedded in our memories. So I think that's a really critical part of being able to use data in a really intelligent way.
So staying in like the real world kind of examples, specifically, you know, maybe the difference between data observations and insights, can you think of a recent example or anything where, you know, those insights have made a significant impact on the media strategy and on the solution that you ended up putting to market?
Yeah, it was funny. I was actually looking at some of the more recent MFA award entries from last year to get some more recent examples. And then I've actually got one that I thought about that I always think is a really great example to think about. You know, one of them, it's back on the cat topic, of course, Jamie. So let's start with that example. And I said, you know, 95% of people love the sound of a purring cat. And it reminded me of a Whiskers campaign that was run a few years back where the agency actually identified that source of purring, why do they love it? Well, they love it because it's very therapeutic. And it would have been very easy to just, you know, blast that message out there in high-reaching media. But as a brand, they wanted to stand out and they were all about finding, okay, well, what's the optimal environment to bring that insight to life, you know, to help people experience that calming effect of a Whiskers cat purr. And so the recommendation was actually to use some of Spotify's audio technology. And they used data to help power that and make sure they were reaching the right audience. But importantly, they were able to emulate those calming effects of a whiskers purr, and they used it to create this 3D audio purr more experience, is what they called it, in moments when they knew that their audience were actually using that medium for relaxation benefits. So it was a really strong way to unlock the insight about how people feel about cats purring and connect that in an environment that was really relevant to how the consumer was was using the medium. And what that ultimately meant, you know, was some increases in some pretty critical critical brand metrics for the brand. So I always find that fascinating, where it's not necessarily about going after the big reaching moment. It's about, okay, well, where's the right moment that we can optimally connect this key point of difference or this key message to our consumers. So that's one I love.
It's funny, you know, staying in that pet world, I remember from my time in commercial radio, there was a lot of campaigns for that sort of category would be very much in that late breakfast, like hitting commuters, which is funny, right? Because the dog's already been fed, or, you know, or conversely, they feed the dog in the evening. And I remember sort of reverse engineering that. And it's actually that time where people feel really guilty, because you get the puppy dog eyes as you're walking out the door and leaving the dog at home alone. So it's just interesting sometimes, like, even like media placement feels like it can really sort of be driven by an insight.
100%. Yeah, it can help you. And it comes back to understanding how people are using it, why are they using it, and what's likely to resonate. So I think your pet example or pet guilt is something that, you know, if you're a pet parent, or we've got any pet parents listening on the podcast, definitely would resonate with that. And I think that simplicity and how we identify that, that's the power of a great insight, right? It's usually simple, and you know it when you hear it, or you know it when you see it.
That's right. And I think, you know, that example is probably a good one of going, why would I, you know, pay a premium to have my commercials play at this time? Why wouldn't I just opt to have them run throughout the day? Or, like, sometimes it's just about stepping out of the data and going, okay, it might not be the most cost efficient, or it might not necessarily deliver the biggest audience or the longest or the widest reach, but in terms of relevancy and in terms of connecting with that audience at the right moment, it sort of intuitively makes sense. You know, it's almost like we're going to step away from the metrics and just think about the humanized aspect of this campaign.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the, you know, the challenges definitely in a media agency is to actually balance those metrics, because you know that they all have a role. And I think there's a lot of data where you can easily measure efficiency, or you can measure reach. I mean, the work that's being done on attention now definitely, you know, helps from identifying those right moments. But also it's what contextually makes sense, because at the end of the day, you know, we are delivering that placement, and we are delivering that placement in a channel with a key message that ultimately is designed to influence human behavior, either what they think or what they feel or what they buy ultimately. And so understanding the connection that you're making with those consumers and being in that right moment, you've then got to weigh that up with, is it more effective to do that? It may feel like it's less efficient, but it may not be more effective in terms of the ultimate business outcome that the client is looking for. And I think that's the balancing act definitely that goes on in agency land.
You get it publisher side too. Like, I think in media sales, what happens is a lot of sales teams have a lot of collateral and a lot of data thrown at them, and it's very much like audience profile data. Like, 95% of our audience strongly agree that blah blah blah. 50% of our audience intend to take action, and there's actually, like, I don't know, maybe I'm cynical, but I'm like, there's just too much of this stuff. Like, it doesn't have any real depth to it. It's trying to have like a bit of a vanity metric. It's trying to show like audience size, or it's trying to convey that, you know, there's a premium aspect to your audience. And I guess some of that actually makes its way out to market, where I think a lot of media sales professionals early in their career actually kind of misattribute data as actually insights. Like, they might go, 97% of the audience agree that, you know, home loan rates are too high. They might think that's an insight. They might actually kind of take that out to market and put it in a response to brief and whatnot. Is there a way that a media sales professional can kind of like expand on this data set that they're provided to try and unearth an insight? Or does this data have like a completely different purpose that it serves? Like, am I maybe sort of overcomplicating it, where this data has a role, insights are a separate thing over here, and never the twain shall meet in this context?
No, they're definitely connected. I think I said, you know, at the very beginning of this podcast, I see data as the fuel to some of you. It's the fuel to the insights engine. And, you know, the stat, so you use the home loan stat just recently, but you've got to ask yourself, you know, why? And it's understanding the why. So, you know, why is it that 97% might strongly agree that your, you know, your medium is a higher involvement environment? Like, what's driving that affinity? Ask yourself, is it something that you're offering that your competitors aren't? Is it, you know, the environment which people feel, you know, they feel it's relatable, or they feel like they belong, or is it an environment that's relaxing? And it's about getting to what is, or what is the why behind that statistic that you're seeing. You know, a stat is just evidence of the insight that's actually driving that. And one of the things, and I think this is critical, whether you're a media sales professional or whether you're, you know, a marketer, it's actually putting yourself in the consumer's shoes to help you get there, and observing your consumers in action to understand why that might be. So for me, the data it's connected. It's just that you've got to go deeper than the data, because it's not the answer.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, these stats are so prevalent in so much media collateral, and I just think they're just unsubstantiated. Like, one of the great examples I had from working in out of home was, we had like this youth product, which was basically digital screens on university campuses. So an out of home product, smaller format, but there was all these stats around, you know, 30% greater ROI, 30% more engaging. And it was kind of like, all we need to do is actually provide even a hypothesis as to why that's the case. Like, we understand it might be third party verified, but why is that actually the case? Because unless you can, you know, you can deconstruct why that is, you might actually not necessarily be able to deploy a campaign correctly. So in that case, we did spend some time going, well, why is that? Is it the fact that it's in a high dwell environment? Is it the fact that it's digital and probably captures attention through the movement? Is it because clients often optimize their creative to speak to a very particular type of audience? Is it the contextual relevance? Like, those are the types of things that, even if you don't necessarily know this is definitively the reason why, just actually being inquisitive about it and just challenging it and being able to kind of relay that to clients, to me, that at least shows like another level of depth behind just throwing out a stat, because anybody can find a way to say that something's 90% better, or, you know, 110% more likely. You know, those things just don't feel like they have any real substance behind them without an additional proof point.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I love that example, and I would encourage the audience to always be inquisitive, you know, about why, you know, why consumers are, why they view your channel in that way. Because at the end of the day, as you've pointed out, you know, there is lots of data, and it's really easy to pull out a big stat. You know, there's a sea of numbers. And the advances recently, you know, in things like AI have made it even easier to surface a big stat that's in your favor. But understanding why that is and how that influences human behavior is really key, because that's what ultimately helps, I think, sell your channel, rather than giving me another stat that, frankly, you know, it blends into all the stats that you're hearing every day. I use this little term internally, particularly when we're, you know, when we're now talking about this in the work that I do now, is the reality is that, you know, we're drowning in data, but we're absolutely frothing for an insight, because it's the insight that ultimately helps us solve the problem and make sure that we're making the right connection with consumers in the right channel, and also aligning our message. You know, it helps us be more potent and actually select media channels that are actually going to deliver the campaign with impact, rather than a whole bunch of, you know, ineffective reach.
Would it be fair to say, I remember somebody commented this on a LinkedIn post and I thought it was interesting, was, it's not a true insight unless you can actually take action off the back of it. Is that a fair statement, do you think, or?
100%. And working in a creative agency at the moment, that is daily life, because it's very difficult to come up with a potent creative idea if you actually don't understand the insight that's driving that and why we are where we are, or why, you know, we're encountering the problem that we are, because you've got to work out, okay, this is where we are now. How do we get to where we need to go?
So you mentioned at the top of the episode, Janelle, around storytelling. Mm. And I'm curious, like, what role does storytelling play in conveying insights to clients and stakeholders? Like, can you sort of unpack that a bit more? Is it just a case of saying, this is what the data is, this is what the observation is, this is the insight? Or is there a storytelling element or a narrative element that you have to bring into that to really make it, resonate with the clients?
Yeah, absolutely. You've got to make it like a short story that they can remember. So, you know, when you read a book or you read something online, there's usually an opening, and then you've got your chapters before you end with the ending. So I think of storytelling as the same way, and it's the same whether you're pitching media or you're pitching creative. You know, a good story makes it much easier to remember. It reminds me of one of the examples that I was looking at earlier. It was a campaign that Gillette ran quite some time ago, I think, and it was in India, and the campaign was titled WALS, and WALS stands for Women Against Lazy Stubble. But the statistics, right, were telling Gillette that their sales were in decline. And then their research was telling them that there was a very significant increase in men who were embracing, you know, the more stubbled look. So it meant that, you know, they weren't using Gillette razors as much. But what they actually discovered, and Gillette was a brand that, you know, historically had spoken to, you know, primarily a male audience, they actually needed to start influencing females, which is where this campaign idea was born from. And it came out of the fact that, you know, women, particularly when they got under the skin of it and they actually spoke to people, you know, women were really preferred that clean-shaven look amongst men. So you've got declining sales, and, you know, you've got all the stats that are around that. Then you've got men who are embracing this stubble look, and then you've got women who go, you know what, yeah, no, don't, we don't prefer that, we don't like that. And so what they did was this, as it's called, WALS, Women Against Lazy Stubble type of campaign, where the brand knew they needed to target both men and women, and they needed to also get that message out there quickly. So again, it'd be really easy from a media perspective to do that quite quickly in a high reach environment, but they also needed to make sure that with a message like that, that it had, real grit and real credibility, because it was born out of a cultural insight. So they resisted the urge to just blast it out there initially. And the first step in stitching that story together was to actually use social influencers to help get some real fuel behind what was the WALS story. But I think when you describe it like that, it's really easy to remember, right? Whereas if I said to you, oh, Gillette sales are declining by 40% and we've seen a 60% increase in men who prefer this, A, it's not as interesting, and B, it's not as memorable. So that storytelling and connecting those dots, it comes into, you know, everything that you need to do. And I think, you know, if your audience can start to do that with their media channels, it helps identify the role for that channel, what's unique and different about it, and where it can be, you know, most relevant and most potent for advertisers.
You know, it's a great example, Janelle, because I think the one thing I remember talking about years ago was sometimes the great idea is only great if the story of how you arrived at the idea is great. And I know that sounds a bit naff, like you don't want to go and go, here's a great story for how we came up with this terrible concept. But it's actually like, if you're pitching, you know, if you're in a competitive pitch scenario and you're going in with a creative idea-led solution, like the pitch theater and the narrative of how you arrived at the idea can almost be equally as important, because what it can kind of do is show that the idea has been stress tested, or show that the process you arrived at was robust. And this is an example I use a lot, but I think it's a great one, where Cochlear, which is a hearing technology company headquartered out of Brisbane, saw a massive increase in people getting their hearing tested. This was around 2021, early 2022. the natural assumption was that, you know, it's elective. People were staying away from going to any sort of medical professionals if they could, because they didn't want to have the whole coronavirus transmission. But then when you actually dug deeper, what a lot of people realized, and this was from talking to the receptionists at all the different centers, was that people didn't realize how much they were lip reading till everyone was wearing a mask. So that's a completely different cause as to why people are getting their hearing tested than just pent up demand. So naturally trying to sell a concept where it's like, we actually have to convey this thing of, you know, basically showing people that there's maybe an issue they aren't aware of, or raising their awareness of an issue that they might be experiencing. It sort of leads to a completely different set of ideation than just couldn't get to the doctor for the last 2 years. You can now. We can safely do it. You know, we've got all this. Like, it just lends itself to a completely different execution. And so to me, though, arriving at that eureka moment after going down a couple of different paths, it actually shows that you've kind of done your homework and you've stress tested the concept before you arrive at the final insight.
Yeah, absolutely. And it shows that you really understand the challenge that the brand is facing, and you're bringing something potentially, you know, potentially new to the table as well. And I think that's also the, you know, part of the storytelling. And you mentioned the journey that you go on. That is part of demonstrating that you actually understand what's really going on, rather than taking things at face value, which would be very easy to do in that example, to go, yep, couldn't get your hearing tested for the last 2 years because of COVID. That would have been really easy. But to actually go to the trouble and actually understand the issue and the difference. And I remember that really resonated with me, you know, the lip reading that used to go on before people had to wear masks. So it also shows that you're really interested, you're passionate, and you understand the business issue at hand. So there's a lot to be said for that.
Well, that example, what I think I took away the most, apart from it being a pretty killer insight, but what I took away from it was they only arrived at it after talking to the frontline reception staff. And so much of what we tend to do, particularly on the media side, is we might go to desktop research, we might go to our planning tools, we might go to a pre-prepared category document. Maybe we sit in a brainstorm room in a bit of a vacuum and try to draw on everyone's shared experience. But you kind of can't unearth great insights like that without going into the field sometimes. And it sort of led me to my next question of, you know, what is a process? Can you share a little bit about your process for generating insights? Is there a process, or is each client challenge and brief so unique that you need to take a little bit of a bespoke approach every time?
You may have alluded to some of my secrets there, Jamie, but when I think of it, it's not like there is a standard process. Generating a good insight, it's like panning for gold. And the reality is it's messy. You do need to get out from, you know, you need to get away from the data and get away from being behind a desk. You need to get out there and talk to people. So whether that is the frontline or call centers or just observing, you know, behavior. If you're working on an FMCG pitch response, observing how people shop the aisles in a supermarket is a great way to start connecting the dots between, you know, a big data point that you may have observed in some of your desktop research and understand the reason why behind that data. So it is looking and experiencing what's actually going on in the real world, and definitely getting out from behind the desk is a piece of advice I would give to everyone, because I can't think of a time where a great insight has come from desk research alone or, you know, a data point alone. And it's also looking at consumers, you know, that's really important, but it is looking at what's going on in the category and what's happening, you know, what's happening culturally in the market at the moment, and also the company that you're working with, because it's that collective process that really helps you sift through the, I said it's like mining for gold. So there's a lot of stuff that you observe and there's a lot of facts that you come across, but are they necessarily an insight, and are they helping you get to great work, is the thing that you've got to sift through. And so that constant question of just asking why something is the way it is, you know, why do we spend so much time scrolling through our Instagram feed or looking at TikTok videos? Like, is it Is it because we like that medium, or is it actually because we're looking for something more and we're looking for companionship or connection? So it is that consistent, just always have in the back of your mind, why is the way that that is, and definitely get out from behind the desk and get out in the real world to experience, as you know, we are asking people to experience, is absolutely key in my view.
Well, I think that's something that just isn't commonplace enough from a media sales professional standpoint. And sometimes even the gesture of doing it, Janelle, can really kind of endear you to your clients. Like, I know, particularly when a lot of people who are working, you know, on the same client over and over and over again, they might be, you know, they might be working on the fourth year, you know, of the same campaign for the same client, just finding a way to keep it fresh and to kind of re-inspire yourself and to go, hey, you know, before we responded to this brief, we sort of went out into the market and we sat in front of a few of your locations and we did a bit of people watching, and we like just showing that you've taken that initiative sometimes can actually really endear you and can just show that you don't take the business for granted. That shows that you've put a little bit of additional thought and effort into the response.
Yeah, it definitely shows that you're just really trying to understand the challenges that they're facing. And there's nothing like experiencing it the way a consumer would to help with that understanding, whether that's going in store and observing behavior, or whether that's, you know, if it's a membership program, we're asking people to sign up for that program. Well, if you're not already a member, sign up yourself and see what that process is like and see what, you know, what communication comes your way. So there's a lot to be said for that. And the other thing, even if you've worked on brands before or you feel like you've done, you know, this before, never assume anything. That's one of the common mistakes I think I see people make, is they think they know, they don't inspire themselves to get out there and discover what they probably don't know right now. I mean, we talked about the hearing implant example just before. That would have been very easy to just go, oh, we know that. We know people couldn't go for the last couple of years. But getting out there helped really, you know, really shape that response. So again, yeah, ditch the assumptions is a piece of advice I would give people for sure.
Yeah, which is funny because it's a good insight. I remember, I think it was Julian Cole said it on a pod I did with him. He said, it's a revelation hiding in plain sight.
Totally. You know,
and so sometimes it's like, it's one of those things of going, damn it, that is so obvious. Like, why didn't we think of that immediately? It's a weird relationship that insights have. And I think when you have a gold one, like when you really drop a good one in the room, you collectively see the room all just kind of go, yep.
Like, that's right. Yep.
So I got a final question before we jump into the listener question. And it's probably a simple question, but there's a lot behind it. Does an insight always have to be a human truth or a consumer insight? Or are there like cultural insights, category insights? Like, are there different types of insights, is I suppose what I'm getting at, or do they all ultimately go back to a fundamental human truth?
I think ultimately what's important is that you pick the most important thing to focus on. And certainly, you know, it's not always a consumer insight that would drive the brief. Sometimes it's culture. You know, sometimes it is category. They all have utility. What I would say about consumers in particular, and particularly because we are, you know, talking to an audience of media sales professionals, is understanding how the consumer is actually consuming your channel, and therefore the opportunity to connect is pretty critical. But it doesn't necessarily always have to ladder up to a consumer insight, but I would say that there is some element of how does this influence human behavior that you've got to ask yourself, because ultimately that's the job, right? That's what we're trying to do by making these connections.
That's actually, you just said something in that I'm going to latch onto. Like, out of home, my 3 years in out of home, there was a really interesting relationship between creative and the format type, and it wasn't necessarily a consumer-led insight, but it kind of was. It was very much around, you know, a large billboard, maybe it's 3 to 5 seconds at most, maybe it's less. So your creative has to be high impact, it has to capture attention, it has to lead with something very emotive, and it has to be a simple message. Some other mediums, like street furniture, probably lend themselves better to frequency. So that's about maybe reinforcing a key USP of your product, or maybe it's a little bit more about some sort of proximity targeting. And then there might be other environments like retail and or office towers that are more high dwell. So that's where you can actually be more text rich. Maybe you can have a little bit more of a, I guess more of a USP or more of a description of the product or something that's a little bit more expanded. But the relationship between the three all comes back to how is that consumer actually consuming the medium and how does the campaign kind of work together? So that to me was like, that's not really a consumer insight, but it's definitely giving consideration to how the relationship between the audience and different mediums, when you're putting a solution or a creative idea to your clients, you need to have that kind of, I guess, you know, almost that fuel behind it to actually sell and rationalize why you've recommended what you're doing beyond the data.
Yeah, absolutely. You need to understand the role of channel across the consumer journey as well. You know, because it does come back to the consumers, like I said before, because we are trying to influence their behavior in some way, whether that's what they think, what they feel, or what they actually do, and the role of different channels. And I think your out of home example was a really good one, where, you know, a big large format out of home where you've only got 3 seconds or less, and you've got to have a big, more emotive, very simple type of brand message versus higher dwell environments, which you arguably would use to surface those key or those killer proof points or those killer reasons to believe, as we know consumers are in a position to potentially convert, because we know the difference between being aware or being primed for a brand versus being closer to the point of conversion and the types of messaging that resonate with people. And it applies to channel selection. The two intrinsically go together. And then I think, you know, laddering that back to understanding how the consumer's consuming those channels is absolutely really one of the keys to truly brilliant work.
There is a tension that exists when you have an agency transaction where a publisher side, there is kind of like a role of channel. You know, if you're in TV, this is your role. If you're in radio, this is kind of your primary role. If you're in out-of-home, this is your primary role. And then sometimes, you know, you actually can sit there and go, okay, we're on the buy because they need cost-efficient reach, maybe an element of integration, and this is about proximity to purchase or whatever. Like whatever it is that your channel's being briefed to do. And I see a lot of tension comes up when the media sales professional then puts a solution back and goes, you know, here's like a full top of funnel response. Like this is for your awareness and this is for your consideration and this is your conversion. And I think like somewhere in the middle, there is like a need to kind of call, okay, this is the role of my channel primarily, but here is how I sort of humanize my response and show how the audience is still engaging with my channel. Yes, I'm delivering reach, but here's how and why they go to my medium. Here's how and why they go to it at different parts of the day. Here's how some of these brand extensions or other products actually kind of strengthen and enhance the message. Like, I think that's where there's sometimes an incongruence or a bit of a tension, certainly from the publisher side when responding to briefs.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's like any response to brief, right? You've got to make sure you meet the brief that the client or the agency or the brand have given you first, and then potentially identify the other opportunities that they haven't thought of. I think it's when you go in with an all singing, all dancing, and you haven't necessarily met the brief that the brand has given you, that never goes well. Whereas the reverse is true. If you deliver on the brief and then identify, and we've thought about this, which may help you with awareness, have you considered how, you know, you could use this in the mix? That's where the opportunity is to actually unlock, you know, those incremental revenue opportunities that you'd be looking for.
I love that.
I can't ask my sales manager that.
Okay, listener question time. Let's jump into this one now.
Hi, Jamie. I work in a high pressure and high volume pitch role inside a media supplier. My role is part of the commercial team but straddles research, strategy, and creative. On an average week, I'll be involved in 10 to 15 brainstorms whilst working across about twice as many live briefs. I don't have anywhere near enough time to really dig into audience insights for every response, but I've seen massive benefit whenever I do, both in terms of the quality of the work and the conversion to sales. Any hacks on getting to the insight quickly when time pressures are a real issue?
That doesn't sound like that uncommon of an issue, Janelle. What's your initial thought reflecting on that?
I feel like I get this question a lot, and it's across, you know, all facets of marketing. It's across all facets of agency that you've never got enough time to get to the good stuff. And the reality is time's finite, and we always wish that we've got more time to improve quality, but that's not always possible. So for me, it comes back to some pretty simple advice and a couple of tips that I've got here. You do have to do the best with the time you've got. And quite often it's about focused time, you know, and it's not about the volume of time that you have. It's how you focused on that particular problem or issue or challenge. You know, it can take 20 minutes or an hour of good quality time versus days of, you know, flitting between things to get to really good work. So number one is around how you focus for the time that you've got. So you're focused on one thing. And I think there's a lot of research to back up that the human brain is not particularly good at multitasking. So carving out whether it's 20 minutes or 2 hours to make sure that you focus on the problem or the challenge is one thing. The other thing that I think about is how you set yourself a time limit for, because what often takes a lot of time in this, particularly in the insights process, is the research gathering. And what you want to do is spend quality time or maximize the time on synthesizing that and getting to the good insight, not on actually collecting the data or collecting the articles and so on and so forth. And so one of the things that you can do is use, you know, there's a whole bunch of AI tools or dashboarding that help you gather the data. And if you're in an organization where you know that there are certain client categories, I'll make them up, you know, FMCG or education or automotive, whatever the case may be, set yourself up for success on, you know, gathering and connecting some of those more category and consumer type insights so that you've already got that to go. So you're not spending time when the brief does arrive, you're not spending time doing the gathering work. And sometimes asking your agency or client for a synopsis of the research they have can be one of the most powerful things that you can do, because they quite often have that at your fingertips. So that's one way to fast track that research process. And then, like I said, I think the other one is really focus the time that you do have. So if it's 20 minutes and you've got it to think about that client problem, think about that problem only. Don't, you know, ditch the distractions and ditch the multitasking. I've certainly felt that those two, it's simple, sounds really simple, really hard to do in practice. But the discipline of those two things has certainly helped me in my career, because quite often in this process you find yourself, you're like, you know, you're drowning in data but you're gasping for an insight, you're gasping to get to a really good idea. But that's actually where you need to spend the time, is getting to the insight and the idea that drive the results.
It's funny, like this feels very familiar to me, this problem of just high volume pitch, constantly having to churn out insights. And the one thing I would say that I've found, it's probably not super related to insight generation, but just a revelation I made. Like if you were to have 50% more time, 100% more time, often the quality of the work isn't going to improve by that much. You know, like in many ways, time constraints don't necessarily like diminish the quality of the work. They just make you arrive at the end result more efficiently. That's been my experience. I think, you know, even sometimes when you've been publisher side and you've gotten a brief with a massive due date, like it's the tendency is to procrastinate until it becomes urgent.
Yeah, that's human nature, right?
And
therein lies the problem. Like, you know, time is finite and, you know, you've got to do the best with the time that you've got rather than sitting there procrastinating. Because whether you had 2 hours or 2 days, there's probably an element of that goes on. It's human nature.
What I would say though, I think you've nailed that, right? Like time is finite. 20 minutes of focused work is actually better than nothing, right? And it's about having discipline. What I'd also say is that of all the 17 billion brainstorms I've been in my life, like, they're actually really inefficient the way that they're run most of the time, because they don't necessarily sort of have phases. Like, a lot of the time it'll be this kind of chaotic regurgitating of the brief, a bunch of questions, people asking questions that were already in the brief, throwing out ideas, getting offended that they, you know, their idea isn't liked by the room. Like, there's a lot to be said for having a disciplined approach where the first 20% of a brainstorm is just talking about the client and the category and not moving into ideation yet. Or interrogating the brief, but then spending time off the back of that to just talk about the category. And anytime I think we've had genuine time constraints, but needed to kind of get a little bit of an understanding of the category or the consumer, it often just comes from talking about it in the room. And to your point earlier, just asking the why, you know, asking the why five times in a row till you arrive at something that feels tangible.
I would say, and this is probably a whole other podcast, but brainstorms, in my experience, are never a great way to they've never unlocked the great idea. They're great to get the team together and get everybody to understand where the challenges lie and where the brand is coming from. But have I ever seen a really powerful solution come out of a brainstorming format? No. So I think there's a whole, and that's, like I said, probably another podcast that we might need to talk about, but there's a whole other way that you get to great ideas.
Keep your ears peeled for Brainstorming is Bullshit, starring Janelle Shinners, coming to our podcast in the UK.
Yeah, never seen it work.
Actually, I think that's Wade Kingsley uses the Brainstorming is Bullshit a lot as well, as does Tim Duggan. So there's a lot of anti-brainstorm, shall we say, anti-brainstorm advocate. Does that make sense? There's a lot of people who share your perspective on that.
Yeah, I just think it's a bit of a myth. We think it's a good idea so we do it, but it doesn't necessarily. I can't say I've ever sat in one of those and gone, yep, that was where we came up with the killer idea.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I've always found that brainstorms are like the default way to do it. And maybe there is something to be said for like having multiple different approaches, but the whole thing around, I guess, really coming up with good insights and really being able to kind of nail that insight, I feel like a brainstorm would be way more functional if you went in with a great insight. Like, if that makes sense, like, I feel like what we're sort of talking about here is like, if you're going to craft a solution, having a great insight to then ideate off with a group of people actually gets a way better result than just an unfocused room of people going through the typical brainstorm format.
Yeah, absolutely right. Focusing people and having a great insight that people can start to riff off, that they understand, is actually key to a good session, that's for sure.
So thank you again for joining, Janelle. Tell us a bit more about VML. What have you got going on this year? What's the stuff that's getting you excited? What are you working on that you want to share?
Oh, well, for me, working in creative, in a creative agency, every day is about getting to great insights or powerful insights. I think we talk about it minute by minute almost. It's what drives creativity. We're certainly working on some pretty big juicy challenges at the moment, some which I can't necessarily talk about, but getting to work with some very, you know, creative minds and wonderful people across all sorts of sectors, whether it's education or entertainment or financial services and sport and tourism, no 2 days are the same. So watch this space. There's certainly a lot to come out in the next 12 months, that's for sure.
Amazing. Well, Janelle, thanks for spending a bit of time with us today. It was great to catch up, and we'll talk to you very soon.
Thanks, Jamie. I've loved being here.